We're starting our second class on the Jewish home. For those of you who weren't with us last week, I want to repeat the disclaimer. This is a class I give because I was asked to give it, but I truthfully would prefer someone with a long white hair of it. I'm giving it as best as I can, and I recommend you guys get other books and other sources to study to complement, supplement, correct, modify what I'm saying. I'm saying it as best as I understand, and I rely on you to verify and think through what of what I say makes sense and what does not. There was a couple that the wife came across a certain herb, certain plant, and it smelled delicious. And she had read that sometimes things that seem good aren't so healthy for you. She knew this might not be such a good idea to eat from that herb, but she didn't resist temptation. She ate from the herb. And then she analyzed the herb, and she went home and watched the evening news. And the bulletin came across the screen and said, the following herb has been spotted growing in this and this location. Do not touch it at all costs. Do not eat from it at all costs. If you've eaten from it, see your doctor immediately. The repercussions within a matter of seconds are irreversible. Whatever you can, stay away from it. And she quickly goes online, does a search, what happens if you eat it? And she sees that people die young and they have no way of reversing it. So she calls the doctor, and the doctor says, how long ago did you eat this? And she says, well, it's been 2-3 hours. He says, I can't help you. So she's sitting there. He says, you know, the antidote has to be served really fast. It's over. I mean, you'll live. Don't worry about it. But we can't reverse the effects anymore. So the woman sits there, and she says, I'm going to die, and my husband's going to marry someone else. So she's sitting there, and that's the thought that's pounding in her mind. And when her husband comes home, she serves him a delicious dish of this herb. And he eats from the herb, and he finishes, and he says, this is spectacular, what did you just give me? And she says, she tells him the name of the herb, and he says, I don't believe you did that. She says, why? What do you mean, honey? So he says, I'm going to die. How can you do that? What do we expect of this husband? I mean, if anyone put himself in that husband's shoes, we know what we do, right? Or we can't even begin to imagine what we do. Why do people get married? We'll get back to the story later tonight. Why do people get married? So, the truth is that we could learn a lot from the blessings that were instituted by the rabbis that we bless a young couple. You know, the Sheva Brachos are really blessings that we wish the couple. That's why it's foolish when a chassan takes one of the Sheva Brachos for himself. Because the whole congregation is supposed to be wishing him something. So what's he saying? I'm wishing myself? It's foolish. I mean, it's not the end of the world, but it's not the way it should be. Other people are supposed to make the seven blessings because we're blessing the couple. And through the course of our learning, we're going to look at these blessings. When we bless the couple, we say, Sameach tesamach, happy, you should make happy, Re'im ha'ahuvim, the friends that are lovebirds, that love one another. Re'im ha'ahuvim, the beloved friends. Kisamechacha yitzirecha began Eden mikedem. Just as you made your creature, Adam and Eve, happy back in the Garden of Eden. Kisamecha yitzirecha began Eden, in the Garden of Eden, mikedem, way back when. So we're wishing them that God should make them happy. And happy like Adam and Eve. We discussed last time that the number one challenge that people have today And the number one responsibility within the marriage framework is dedication. This is right. There's the story of a Rebbe, Hasidish Rebbe, who went on a date with his wife, and he had a hunchback. So the wife came back from the date and she said, "I want to marry a hunchback." So he said, "Tell her that in Shemayim we're supposed to be married, and she was supposed to be the hunchback. And I came in and I said, I don't want her to have to go through life being a hunchback. I'll take it upon myself. But if it bothers her, I could change things." We live in a world where from the moment we start understanding what's going on around us, we only know ourselves. Think about how a child's born. A child is born. He knows he's hungry. He knows he cries. Doesn't even have to think about it. Then he gets food. Something bothers him. He cries. He gets food. He gets taken. Child grows up a little bit more. Starts understanding there's this sweet, fluffy being that holds him. And grows up a little bit more. Learns that his cry could really make things move in the world. Mm-hmm. And when child is about 1 year old, and even when child's half a year old, if you'll have people yelling in the room, the child will start crying, because in a child's mind, everything revolves around the child. So if people are upset, they're upset at the child. Child becomes 2, 3, 4, child starts understanding there's a world other than me. But we never completely outgrow this. If you come to the teller and you want to buy a ticket, and the teller has a scowl on their face, what's the first thing you think? They're an anti-Semite. They don't like me. They have something with tall people, short people, fat people, skinny people, blonde people, people with a beard, people. Does my breath smell? They have a scowl on their face because they were just told they're being fired. It has nothing to do with you. You don't exist in their mind. But from our perspective, the second we see someone that's upset, we interpret it as to do with us. To an extent, we don't outgrow. To the day we die, we don't outgrow. The more intelligent we are, the more we can figure out. Our logic tells us, no, they're not upset at me. There's nothing to do with me. You understand that in marriage, this is a big challenge. I'm marrying someone else. What's that all about? So we said we bless the couple as Re'im Ha'ovim, the beloved friends. What does it mean to be a friend? Because to an extent, that might be step one in understanding what marriage is all about, if we understand what friendship is all about. So the Rambam writes on the Mishnah and Pirkei Avos, Uknei Lecha Chaver, acquire a friend. The Rambam writes there are different types of friendships in the world. There's a friendship which is a beneficial friendship. We could be partners in a business. We both get something out of it. So we're interested in this friendship. So long as I get something from it, you get something out of it, so this friendship will continue. The second, I think there's more to be gained from a different relationship, a different business partnership, I could and terminate the relationship. It's interesting that the Rambam calls that friendship. We wouldn't use the term. Or would we? I have situations frequently where I blush, where I feel uncomfortable just sitting where I am. It happens to me when I'm on a bus or I'm in a store and they start playing a love song. And I don't blush, unfortunately, because of the vulgar things they're saying. I blush because the terms they're using to describe the relationship are embarrassing to me. The person says, "I love the way you look. I love the way your hair flows." He starts describing a million things. I said, "Wait a second. You don't love her, you love you. And you're not even embarrassed about it. You sit there listening to the love song, and he's singing about how he loves himself. What do you love? What do you love about the person? I don't understand." So if she didn't have beautiful golden locks, then you wouldn't love her? So what do you love? You don't love her. You love the lox. You know, there was a famous story about a rabbi who came across a student, and the student had a nice piece of fish he was about to sit down and eat. Now, once upon a time, people didn't have so much food. So when this student had a piece of fish, he was really happy. He was salivating. And he sat there and he took out his fork and his knife. And the rabbi says to him, what you eating? So the student says, fish. Oh, I love fish. So the rabbi says, really? You know, I think if you loved fish, you'd put them in an aquarium, you'd sing to them, you'd wave to them, you'd get them fish food. You're eating the fish because you love them? No, you don't love the fish. You love yourself. Well, to a great extent, that's what these love songs are all about. They don't even say a word about anything of any meaning between them and the other person. And they're not embarrassed about it. So when I hear these things on the bus, I blush. How could a person stand there and everyone's listening to a man singing or a woman singing about how they love themselves? I don't know why I blush. To me, I'm ashamed to even hear such things. The Rambam writes, so what other types of friendship are there? The Mishnah describes knei lecha chaver, acquire a friend, buy a friend. What does it mean to buy a friend? I'll give you $1 million, you'll be my friend. No, it's not. It's not the idea. We view friendship as something that requires an investment. Friendship is about giving, and friendship is about mutual appreciation. The Mishnah describes what type of love will last and what type of love won't last. So you think, if we're describing a type of love that would last, we take the ideal couple in all of history and say that's love that will last. The Mishnah doesn't do that. The Mishnah doesn't even take a description of a man and a woman. And when the Mishnah wants to describe a love that was problematic, the Mishnah takes the following story. King David had a son named Amnon. King David had a daughter from a beautiful girl that he had captured at war, and they married. And this daughter was also exceptionally beautiful. Her name was Tamar. And Amnon desperately wanted to marry Tamar. He couldn't. He didn't think there was any way it was permissible, even though technically, halachically, because her mother was a Gioras, they were technically not siblings, and they could have gotten married. And he tries to figure out a way, and he can't, and he can't, and he can't. And finally he gets sick, wishing he had Tamar. Sick over the fact that he wants to be with Tamar. And then he has his opportunity. Tamar comes to take care of him because he's sick, and he takes her forcibly. And 10 minutes later, he kicks her out the door and tells his lad, lock the door after her. 10 minutes. The whole story. 10 minutes, 15 minutes. He spent, we don't know how many days, weeks, months, dying to have Tamar. And minutes later, he kicks her out the door and tells his lad, lock the door after her, don't let her back in. And the Torah, the Navi says he hated her. He hated her more than he ever loved her. How'd that happen? Half hour ago, where was he? Where is he now? So when the Mishnah wants to give us an example of a love that's not true love, the Mishnah takes an example of a man and a woman. Because just because they're from the opposite gender doesn't mean they'll have true love. Who did Amnon want? He wanted to satisfy himself. Very often, people think they love someone. They do. They love themselves. There's nothing to do with the other person. The other person doesn't exist. They exist as per what pleasure a person thinks they'll give them. So that's which type of friendship? That's the type of friendship the Rambam described, where people think they stand to gain something. I have news for you. Many, many marriages in the Western world are that type of friendship. There's a psychologist who's such a big psychologist, they fly him into the United States. And he goes there, he lives here in Israel, and he goes there and he treats clients for a period, and then comes back to Israel. And he said, a few months ago, he said he has a hard time going back to the United States anymore. because he's had so many couples coming before him the last year and a half, ever since this economic crisis hit. He's had so many couples coming before him where the wife says, I married him for a different lifestyle. I don't have to put up with this. He can't afford the lifestyle we used to have together. Now I suddenly hear he wants to sell the car. He says we have to sell the apartment. He says we have to move to a cheaper neighborhood. It's not what I married him for. That's not the life I bought into. He says he's so sickened by it, he has a hard time flying back to the United States to continue servicing these clients. Because they're holding on the brink of divorce because the wife says, that's not the lifestyle I wanted. Yeah. There are a lot of people, a lot of couples, that are living in a relationship because it's mutually beneficial. That's not friendship. That's one type of friendship. The Rambam surprisingly uses the term friendship about that. It's a partnership. The way we in Judaism view marriage is way, way, way beyond that. We're learning on Fridays the Drasha Saran. And the Drasha that we're learning, the Ran, begins with a quote from the last prophet, Prophet Malachi. And the last prophet concludes the last prophecy with the following discussion. The Jewish people turn to God and they say, Pamavtanu. Why do you love us? Right? How many songs, how many ballads have been written? Enumerate to me the way in which thee loves me, right? In which I love thee. So the Jewish people, the last prophet ends his last prophecy with the following question. The Jewish people turn to God and say, why do you love us? Legitimate question. Now, we could understand that the last prophet, Malachi, envisaged the Jewish people exiled, the Christians, the Muslims, every nation stepping all over us and saying, you're no longer the chosen people, God no longer loves you. And that was quite possibly why it was so important to conclude prophecy with that last discussion. The only problem is, what's the answer? God says, you know, Esav and Yaakov are brothers. And I love Yaakov. Yeah, okay. We asked for a reason. We know you love Yaakov. It isn't uncommon that a wife will ask her husband, why do you love me? The worst thing the husband could do is answer. You could limit it. You could explain. One reason, two reasons. What do you mean? You could say, I love who you are. And there are so many positive traits that you have that I admire, such as, but is that why you love her? I hope not. God doesn't tell us why. Because love isn't defined based on an A or a B or a C. It's the whole person. It's when you have a whole person, when you have two pieces of the puzzle that fit, they fit. You're going to start defining it's this angle and that angle. No, that's not it. It's the whole person. When the Mishnah wants to describe to us a relationship that was true love, the Mishnah takes the following relationship. We have King Saul. He's the first king of the Jewish people. And he's erred. And the prophet told him the kingdom will not remain in his family. It's a pretty bad error. Pretty hefty price. So he has a son-in-law who's been exceptionally successful in the military campaigns, called David HaMelech. And everyone starts getting the feeling that David's the next one to the throne. We know that the prophet Shmuel already went and anointed David that he would be the next one to the throne. King Saul has a son who's the rightful heir to the throne. Yonasan, Jonathan. And we would think that if King Saul has been trying to see to it that David is dead, so Yonasan would be 10 times more anxious to see David dead. What does the prophet tell us? Yonasan saves David from Saul's hands. Yonasan tells David, I know God wants you to be king, I know you will be king, and I will be under you. You will be king. And the verse says that Yonasan loved David. Can we mention that? the potential. His father has the throne. He's supposed to be next in line. And here his brother-in-law is going to take it from them. Take it from their tribe, the tribe of Benjamin, that was just killed out by the rest of Israel. They had only 600 people, the tribe of Benjamin. They were given this honor that God chose the first king from the tribe of Benjamin. And now he's the next in line. He could maintain it within the family. He has David within his grasp. And what does he tell David? I know you're going to be king. And I'll help you. And he does help him. He does help him. He saves him from his father. And he tells him, you'll be king and my father will not catch you and I will be under you. David HaMelech says, when he eulogizes Yonasan, he says, his love for me was greater than the love of women. He had nothing to gain from our relationship. Everything to lose. And yet he wanted the relationship. He valued who David was. That's true love. True love isn't about what I have to gain. True love is about who is the person. Why would Yonasan love David? He doesn't love David because of what David can give him. David could only take from him. David has nothing to give him, technically. David is his threat until David takes the throne and thereafter. And Yonasan recognizes the threat. He makes David promise that he will protect his children. Yonasan does make David promise then. But Yonasan loves David and takes care of him. So when we start seeing what love is about, we see an example where a person has what to lose and they value who the person is. That's Ahava Sheinah Tluya B'Davar. Ahava that's not contingent on anything external. Love that's contingent on who I am and who you are. I value who you are. That's where love begins. We begin the blessings for Chatan and Kala. We begin with a fascinating blessing. They're standing there under the canopy. They're just getting married. And the first blessing is, blessed are you, Hashem, who fashioned the human being. Okay. What does that have to do with anything? Yotzer ha'adam. You gave shape to the human being. And what does that have to do with them? We say that ha'adam, the human being, is not a man alone or a woman alone. A human being, a complete human being, is a pair, a couple. A person is not called Adam. He does not attain that level of potential godliness that we call him Adam, a human being, until he's married, until he's a part, a pair. God created Adam, if you look at the verses in Bereishis, as male and female, partners. And so, we refer to a man as plag gufa, half a body. He's half. And a person has to be aware that he's missing his other half. I don't believe in saying better half. Who knows who's better? It's a game. It's the other half. We're both halves. And there are areas where he's better and there are areas where she's better. We should value the areas where she's better. We don't have... Okay. Makes her happy to say the better half. Say the better. People think when they contemplate marriage or not, or when they contemplate divorce or not, they think, so, if I get divorced, so, I'll have to buy the food myself, do the laundry myself. I'll be like a car with half a tank filled with gas. But I'll have many, many, many aggravations removed from my life. It's not that way. A person that's divorced is with half an engine. Now get someone. You're not a car. We're going to compare it to a car. A person is whole, he's a human being, he's an Adam, when he's a peer. If people want to be religious, we discussed last week that very often people use religious claims against their spouse. Maybe God had someone else in mind. Maybe with someone else I'd be a better Jew. Maybe I'm not meant to put up with A, B, C, and D. If you want to be religious about it, and I say that in quotation marks, then the attitude is, she and I is a given. It's a fact. Again, remember, our class is post-marriage. Once you've been married, then we have to do a switch in our minds. And here it's mind over matter. We have to decide. This is a given. It's not a question, is it with her or not? Because if it's a question, no marriage can live up to that question. There was once a couple that had issues. They separated thinking they're going to get divorced. And then they decided they're getting back together again. So a very smart rabbi took them aside and said, you are not experimenting. No experiment in marriage could ever work, because every day has so many difficulties and challenges that if you're going to keep a scorecard, that's it. By the end of 3 days, you're going to have a list a mile long why this isn't going to work. If it's an experiment, it doesn't work. Marriage can never work as an experiment. Doesn't matter how perfect the spouse is. The second it's a question whether it works or not, it ain't working. The only way marriage can work is when you jump in with both feet, which is sometimes difficult as people get older. It's one of the difficulties that people have when they get older. They've seen so much, they have so many friends, they're so set in their ways. It's very hard for them to take both feet and jump off the diving board. But you know what happens when you try to jump off the diving board with one foot? You can get really hurt. What? So the only way to jump off is with both feet. Same thing with marriage. Marriage is about jumping in and this is with this person I'm meant to be. And from the day we get married onward, that's not a question. The question is, how do we make it work? But how do we make it work? Bearing in mind the story of that Rebbe. Meaning, when we had a couple that 3 days after the wedding, she was in a difficult car accident and burnt her face. And now she no longer looked very human. And now the chassan comes in and says, how am I supposed to deal with that? So think about it. Wait a second. God decreed that one of you would have their face burnt because you're a pair. It could have been you. It could have been her. For some reason it was chosen it would be her. Now think about it. It's easier said than done. I'm not making light of the situation. But at the end of the day, we have to know that the correct attitude is that. I'll get to you in a second. Let's go back to the story in the beginning of class. That wife sounds unusually cruel. But now let's begin the Torah. God puts Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. Eve is seduced to eat from the forbidden fruit. Our sages say that when Eve ate from the forbidden fruit, she saw the angel of death approaching towards her. She said, oh no, now I'm going to die. And Adam's going to marry someone else. And so she took the fruit and went to Adam and said, have some of this delicious fruit. And Adam ate from the fruit. And then Adam said to Chava, he said, what'd you give me? I feel like a totally different person ever since I ate that. And Chava said, it was from the Eitz Hadas. I just gave you from the forbidden fruit. What would the average husband say? So it wasn't on the evening news. So it wasn't in her. It was the story of Adam and Chava. So I'll tell you what Adam said. When God comes to Adam and says, why'd you eat from the fruit? What does Adam say? He says, God, look, you put me here in the Garden of Eden alone. I didn't sin. I was okay, right? Then you gave me a wife. And I assume you wanted me to trust this one. I did. Without her, I was perfect. With her, this is where I'm at. God, according to one understanding, God said, your sin was not that you ate from the fruit. Your sin was the way you spoke about your wife. Your sin was your lack of appreciation for who I gave you. That you ate from the forbidden fruit, you didn't know. She fed you. But that you speak that way about your wife. No appreciation? The woman you put here with me. Wait a second, Adam. Let's reverse. Where did this whole story begin? Adam couldn't find a partner who would be his ezer, his partner, his assistant. Adam went from animal to animal and said, every animal you created bears God. I don't have a pair. I'm all alone. And none of them match for me. So God put him to sleep and created the woman. Why did Adam have to be created alone? Why is it that every other animal is created male and female? So I have a theory, which I haven't found written anywhere. I think it's true. I think that, I don't know, this is my own. I'm not saying it's Torah, I'm saying it's my theory. Maybe this is what the Torah meant to say, maybe not. I think that one of the prime challenges that men have in this world, and primarily towards their spouses, is lack of appreciation, taking them for granted. And to an extent, we say that the stories of the Garden of Eden are there to teach us the prototypical challenges of men and women. The whole story of the Garden of Eden, according to the Malbim, is a mashal. whatever that means. So it's there to tell us something about the beginning of humanity. And if Adam's sin, or one of Adam's sins, was the way he spoke about his wife, that he didn't appreciate her, so it's possible that God foresaw that. And God wanted him to be lonely. God creates us separate. We have to go seeking that lost rib. Why? Because after we'll find her, there are going to be plenty of times where we're going to think, gee, I was pretty good without you. I didn't have all these problems. Lack of appreciation. And so, when God finishes the curses, God curses Adam, God curses Chava, Eve, God curses the snake, God curses the earth, we finish a whole series of curses, and then it says, Adam gave her a name. So now she was Haisha, the woman. And then it says, Vayikra Adam Shem Ishto, Adam named his wife Chava, Eve. He, why? Because he hayeta im kol chai. She's the mother of all living. We would have thought, call her mother of death, right? And she brought death to the world. No. Adam learned his lesson. So Adam calls her Chava. Perspective. Now let's go back to that story. So the husband eats from the earth, right? And he says, I don't believe you gave me that. Legitimate. But what does he do next? Sometimes in life, we have to think, where are we holding? We have to recognize the issues. We have to see how we can resolve the issues. But we have to know that in life, you and me, she and I, is a given. That's a given. It's not a discussion. All discussion begins after that. In our class 4 years ago, I gave us a class. The first half hour was a series of stories of traumatic things that happened to couples. And how do we expect couples to deal with them? I feel like you guys are too young to tell you the stories. I'd rather focus on the positive. Right? So, you want, they're all online. One area where this comes up is when couples have a challenge with regard to fertility. A couple could be married a year or two, three, and they can't have kids. And then they go to the doctors, and the doctors tell them, well, A, B, C, and D. Let me tell you a story that happened in this neighborhood. So a woman who I brought to lecture, not in Mahomir, in other places, they come to the doctors, they check her out, they check her some more, they check her some more. And then this doctor, who's considered the biggest expert in the country, walks in and says, I've been through your tests. Lady, I don't think I could call you lady. I don't know what you are, but you're not a woman. I don't know what creature you are, but a woman you're not. You can't have kids. There's no way you're going to have kids. Because look at her hormone level. You're half male on this, you're that. True story. So the woman is devastated. The top expert in the country just told her she can't have kids. So of course she and her husband go home devastated. And then they decide they're not giving up. He's not God. With all due respect to him. So they go to a more modest doctor in Shaare Tzedek. And they ask the doctor, what are our odds of having kids? So the doctor says, I'm not God. God could tell you your odds. I could tell you that you and I will form a partnership from here on in, and we will try. And God will help, and you will have kids. But odds is God's job, not mine. You and I, our job is to try. So we're going to try. And they start working. And she miscarries one child, and another child, and another child. She's already miscarried, I don't know how many. And at some point, she hits a pregnancy. They have to sew up her womb every time she got pregnant. At some point she hits a pregnancy where she's lying in bed. She couldn't hold the child if she was standing. Lying in bed for over 6 months with her stomach sewn up so that she doesn't miscarry the child. And after 6 months, she feels like she has to give birth. So we'll skip all the details. They have to cut her open, all the things, they weren't expecting it. And the babies are born prematurely, two babies, twins. And they're in danger, lying in the hospital. And after a long story, which was skipped, about how they finally made it out alive, comes time for their bris. So the doctor from Shaarei Tzedek calls up this other doctor and says, I want you to do me a favor. I have a very special bris coming up and I want you to be present. So the other doctor says, what do you need me for? He says, believe me, I need you. Come, it's a special bris. I want you here. And this other doctor came to the bris. And when he came to the bris, the mother walked over to him and said, I just wanted to tell you, you're not God. That's all. Look at these two children. You said it can't happen. These are the two children. Now she lives here. She lives a 5-minute walk from here. But why am I bringing this story? Because, A, I think it's a beautiful and important story. But sometimes couples are faced with challenges that the husband hears this about his wife. Right? Imagine what the husband's thinking when the doctor tells him, you didn't marry a woman. Look at her hormone levels. This isn't the woman. She can never have kids. You want to adopt, you want to do whatever you want, fine. But this ain't happening. And it's not the only story. I could tell you other stories, but we don't have time. The question is, what's our attitude? Very often when we have major challenges in life, especially when the challenges revolve around one of the spouses, so what happens is the other spouse starts thinking, it's her problem, she's the lamb. It's his problem, he's got problems. And unfortunately, in our day and age, it happens over more minor issues. When couples have spats and have other difficulties, they're very quick to say, this isn't going to work. No. If you got married, then it's meant to work. And now the question is, how are you going to make it work? It's up to you to make the marriage sweet. Marriage, our sages say, is the biggest blessing God can give a man and a woman, a couple. It's the biggest blessing there is. There's no bigger blessing, provided that we make it into that blessing. Remember, we're not Adam. We're not human without it. But that doesn't mean it's going to be easy. It's going to require a lot of work. And that's what we're going to learn about. Just 1 second. Yeah.
I just wanted to ask if there's a concept of actual soulmates, and if so, do you always end up with that soulmate?
You always end up with that soulmate.
So there is like a predetermined...
Whoever you end up walking down the aisle with, it was predetermined should be your soulmate. The term soulmate is misused.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to understand.
It's correct after the fact.
In retrospect.
People think there's a soulmate and maybe this isn't them. Wrong. This is them. And we're short on time. In a nutshell, if you don't like what you see, you're seeing a mirror image. You're seeing what fits you. If you don't like it, so think about who you are. Everyone gets married with high anticipation. And then there's a point of, this isn't what I expected. Disappointment. But that happens in every marriage. A person has to recognize, well, then obviously this is what I'm supposed to go through. Okay, so now let's figure out how to make it work. And we're going to discuss it. It's not as simple as that. But the first thing we must have is the attitude. I could answer your question or say one more point. Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah.
That's something I want to say. I want to ask a man if I could marry his daughter. And I it was after a long relationship, it wasn't just like I was with, but I remember what he told me, and it stuck with me. I think it always stuck with me. He said, marriage, you give, it's not 50-50. It's not one person gives 50%, the other person gives 50%. Both people giving 100%. You know, it's not what you both try, you know, I give 50 and I expect the other person to contribute, and it's not going to work.
Beautiful. Yes, that's very nice. Shukra. Okay, we have one more minute. Yeah, David.
Why in Genesis is like the marriages are followed by first one, like death introduced into the world, second, Genesis 6, it says like Bnei Elohim and the daughter of the man, and then God shortens the lifetime of man to 120. Like,
let's look at it differently. Adam remains married to his wife in spite of the challenges, and they build a world out of it. Cain builds a world in spite of the destruction he does. Tubal Cain, after he kills Cain and it's decreed that 7 generations are going to die, his wives stay with him. The real destruction we see in married life in Genesis, if you want to view it there, is where the Torah starts describing how man would marry one woman to procreate and one woman for pleasure. That's where we start seeing. The second man, male, approaches marriage with an attitude, I know what I want to get out of this, so let me see how I can maximize what I get out of this. That's when marriage goes on the decline and human morality goes on the decline, and it's quickly followed with murder, paganism, everything that brings about human decline. If we want to view it through the eyes of marriage, I think that might be a different way we could look at it. Okay.